As summer gets underway, lots of you are heading to our lakes and rivers for fun. Today, a check on our water health when it comes to Illinois' waterways. And after a temporary delay, the Trump administration will now begin processing stalled or denied visa applications for international medical graduates trying to enter U.S. residency programs. What's the latest on this H-1B visa program, and what can we expect before residency programs begin on July 1st? Also, the Consul General of Guatemala joins us from Chicago to share the latest on the tragic volcano eruption in his home country and how Guatemalan Americans here are organizing relief efforts. Plus,
the whistle. It's done! It's over! Trinidad has dethroned the United States, knocking them out of the World Cup.
The World Cup starts tomorrow without the U.S. national team, but that doesn't stop soccer fans in Illinois from getting excited. We'll help you with that. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, July 1st, is a big day in the medical residency world. Coming up this hour, we're going to be talking about what things are looking like in Illinois for immigrant doctors, given the Trump administration's delays in processing visas. Also, Guatemala's Consul General in Chicago joins us to talk about how his home country is coping after that volcano eruption. We'll also learn how people across Illinois are trying to help with recovery and relief efforts. But first, did you know that there are more than 120,000 miles of rivers across Illinois? It's not just an important source of drinking water, but especially now that it's summer, rivers and lakes are a great way to spend time outdoors. So we thought we would check in on the health of our waterways. Joining me now are Carol Hayes, Executive Director of the Prairie Rivers Network. She's in studio with me here in Urbana. On the line from Springfield is the Natural Resources Defense Council's Josh Mogerman. Carol, Josh, welcome back to the 21st, both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Nyla, for having me.
Good morning.
Good morning. Carol, let's start with you. The last time you were here was actually to talk about algal blooms. And you were just sharing with me before we went on air about an algal bloom picture that you got sent of the Illinois River up by Starved Rock. Was that just a couple of days ago someone sent that to you?
Yeah, so about 3 days ago, someone who follows us on Facebook sent us a picture of an algal outbreak, is what we're beginning to call them now, up on the Illinois River near Starved Rock, and wondering, you know, what to do about the fact that he had seen this event. As we talked last time I was here, these can be very harmful for people and for animals. You don't always know when you see an outbreak what's in it and how harmful it can be. I asked if this was a place people would normally boat or swim, and he said, oh, yes, of course. People would be, you know, jumping in the water out of boats. I asked if there was any marked evidence, you know, from the state that this was a problem area. And I think because of its location, it certainly wasn't obvious or well known and was not marked. The challenge we have in Illinois, and this is true really everywhere, is that when you see a problem like an algal outbreak, you really don't know who to call, who to inform, to let others know that this could be a real problem for public health. And one of the things we would like to see is that these algal outbreaks are better tracked and that there is some system for informing the public, whether that is a local EPA office or IDNR or public health department, and that notifications are sent to the public and posted.
Carol, can you remind us what this would look like? So you said someone sent a picture. Perhaps people remember the big algal outbreak, the bloom that happened in Ohio a couple of years ago. What does it look like when you're just out on if you're boating or you're kayaking or whatever, and you come across something like that?
So the most obvious telltale sign is it's going to be a green slime on the top of the water. But that doesn't necessarily always appear that way. So, for example, while the green slime may have dissipated, there still may be toxic residue in the water. So, you know, water still could be problematic. We get these outbreaks increasingly in shallow waters when it gets warm and when sunlight is able to penetrate the water and cause algae to bloom. And it's because there's too much, you know, nutrients, essentially things that feed plants, fertilizer in the water that's allowing the plant life, the algal life, to bloom. So you definitely want to stay away from water that looks green or has a green slime on the top of it.
As we're talking about this with Carol and Josh, you're welcome to tweet your questions or comments. You can also give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455, as we're talking about the health of our rivers and lakes. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. Josh, the NRDC, you all look at beach water quality. That's something that's pretty well-regulated throughout Illinois as well. What can you tell us about our beaches throughout Illinois?
Well, one of the things that has always been interesting to me to look at is the difference in quality between the beaches that we see along our coasts and here in the North Coast, along the Great Lakes. We have probably about twice as much in the way of E. coli levels in the beaches in particularly along Lake Michigan, in Illinois and Ohio, those sorts of areas. And part of that has to do with being in a closed system, and part of that has to do with just the level of industrial and agricultural activity that we have going in these areas and the sorts of runoff making their way into our lakes. And that certainly is a problem. You know, I'm a parent, when I take my son to the beach, I want him to have a good time. The last thing I want him to deal with is a sour stomach or having to spend a lot of time in the bathroom as a result. That is not a good time at the beach. So it's really important for people to know before they go. And as it relates to particularly the Great Lakes beaches up in Chicago, you can get pretty good near real-time updates on the quality of the water in a lot of those beaches. Unfortunately, in a lot of the other waterways that we're talking about, rivers and streams and even smaller lakes in the state, it's much harder to get that real-time information. And so it's really, really important to be aware of what's going on in the areas. You definitely don't want to hit the beach days right after it rains. There's a lot of stuff that gets washed into the water. And oftentimes those are the things that not only contribute to those bad beach experiences, but also contribute to the problems that Carol is talking about as it relates to algae blooms, which are a huge, huge problem all over America.
And Carol, what does it, to Josh's point about beaches, what do we know, as you've just sort of laid out for us, how difficult it is to track the water quality of the rivers and lakes? So what's some advice that you, what do we know, first of all, before we get to advice for people, what do we know about the overall health of the system?
So we know that approximately 2/3 of the water bodies in Illinois, and that's everything from streams to lakes to large rivers, are impaired in one way or another, meaning that they either can't be fished from, we shouldn't drink water from them, or we shouldn't recreate in them, play in them, swim in them. And those have particular meaning under the Clean Water Act, which regulates water bodies. And when a water body is impaired for any of those reasons, you can't use it in one of those ways, then there should be a plan for cleaning it up and restoring it to the health that it once had so that it can be enjoyed. That's very challenging. It takes people working together. It takes an understanding of where the problems in the water are coming from, and then really using ways that we know will reduce those problems, putting them in place to protect waters in the future. It costs quite a bit of money and time and goodwill on people's part to work together to make that happen.
And Carol, how do you know that 2/3 figure? Where does that does that come from? Then reports made under the Clean Water Act. That's how we know where that 2/3 figure is coming from.
The Illinois EPA provides that data for us and to the U.S. EPA, and that's how those of us who really work on water issues track the health of our water bodies in the state.
We're talking about the health of our waterways with Carol Hayes, Executive Director of the Prairie Rivers Network, who's in studio with me here in Urbana. On the line from Springfield, the NRDC's Josh Mogerman is also with us. Carol, we just had a caller. Our phone number, by the way, is 1-800-222-9455. If you're driving, as our next caller was, and left a message, that's okay to do, too. We want you to be safe. You can also tweet, but do not tweet and drive. Jan from Potomac was just called and asked a question about coal ash pollution. With Middle Fork and Vermilion, can we? I know that Prairie Rivers Network has been very active on this front. Can you just give Jan an update on that?
Sure. So, as we all know, the Middle Fork of the Vermilion River is our state's only national scenic river. It's designated by the federal government, and that means it has an added level of protection over and above other rivers and streams in the state. The Middle Fork is threatened by several coal ash ponds, basically big holes dug in the ground in which coal ash was put while the Dynegy Vermilion power plant was in operation. That plant shut down a number of years ago, but the coal ash ponds remain. And because the way that these ponds are dug, they are simply dug in the ground with any kind without any kind of lining, and they're susceptible to leakage into groundwater. And so what's happening, if you get on the river, and we hope people will get on that beautiful river this summer, it is so pretty to be out there, but it's really jarring to see things, you know, chemicals seeping through the wall of the river, basically, the where just below where the power plant sits, into the waterway. And so we are seeking protection for the river using the Clean Water Act and hoping that the river will be restored and protected and that the bank of the river will no longer seep into the waterway.
And that's a lawsuit that you all filed, Prairie Rivers Network filed, I believe it was a couple of weeks ago, against Dynegy Energy?
Right. Dynegy was purchased by Vistra, and we filed the lawsuit against Dynegy and are seeking protection for the river through the Clean Water Act.
Carol, you mentioned the Clean Water Act. The Senate, I just wanted to ask just about the federal role. And Josh, I would love to have you weigh in here. The Senate Farm Bill is actually being marked up today. And apart from the Clean Waters Act, I'm just thinking about the Farm Bill and its role in conservation. And Josh, what would you like to see in terms of the federal government when we're looking at regulation, particularly when it comes to waterways?
Well, there are a few things. First of all, you know, one real concern around the Farm Bill that's not necessarily directly a waterway issue, but one that we are really concerned about is the way it deals with farm chemicals and removing some significant health protections that are oddly associated with the Endangered Species Act that are really, really important to ensure protection for wildlife, but also for our farming communities, which are on the front lines of some really significant concerns around the impacts of ag chemicals on the folks who are handling them. Beyond that, there are a number of efforts underway right now in Congress to roll back a specific part of the Clean Water Act, which is the Clean Water Rule. It's somewhat confusing. The similarities, but the Clean Water Rule was put in place in 2015 to sort out some confusion over what waterways are protected under the Clean Water Act, and particularly around some of the smaller waterways, wetlands, headwaters, streams, those sorts of things. And through a pretty long and involved scientific process, the Clean Water Rule put in place new rules that made clear that those parts of waterways that flow into larger waterways like rivers get protections. And that's pretty important because, you know, we're talking about water bodies that flow into and support larger sources of water that are the drinking water source for 117 million Americans. We're talking about, you know, wetlands that cover 110 million acres. The Trump administration has been trying to roll back the Clean Water Rule. The EPA has put forth a proposal that it has since rolled back. We're expecting to hear perhaps a new proposal for an alternative rule to come from them this week. But in the meantime, Congress has stuck provisions in a number of different bills, which would sort of be a backdoor way to repeal these rules. And it's something that is a real concern for us, and I think should probably be a real concern for most of your listeners. It's a a very popular rule, and we think it's a really important one to protect public health and drinking water sources.
So that's the NRDC's perspective. Carol, when we're thinking about the state, we've just been hearing about what's happening at the federal level. What about at the state level in terms of when you're looking at our waterways? What is important to you right now with Prairie Rivers Network?
So one of the things that we have been looking at, and again, using information from Illinois EPA, is the growing presence of nitrates in groundwater, not just in surface water. And we know that, you know, we've had nitrates in drinking water reservoirs for some time, and many communities have had to buy expensive nitrate removal facilities to deal with those growing
like in Decatur.
Threats. Like in, well, Decatur, also in Danville, but other communities are also having to do this. It's expensive. It's expensive to purchase it, and it's expensive to run it. But now even smaller communities are having to purchase this costly equipment. And, you know, the I think the important thing to point out is that conservation can play a huge role in protecting our water quality. And because most of the activity that's contributing to these kinds of problems in waterways is coming both from, you know, agricultural, not just runoff, but tile drainage into waters, it's a challenging problem to address. But we know, and the Farm Bill certainly is recognizing this, that conservation can be a much less costly and just as impactful way of treating the problem. This isn't the only source of the problem, but it's the primary source in Illinois. And when we think about how we encourage the treatment of the land, that becomes really critical in the health of the water. And I think we kind of miss this relationship.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it at that, but I want to thank Carol Hayes with the Prairie Rivers Network, Josh Mogerman with NRDC, a national spokesman for them based here in Illinois. Both of you, thanks for giving us a little bit more insight into our waterways.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. After a temporary delay, the Trump administration will now begin processing stalled or denied visa applications for international medical graduates trying to enter U.S. residency programs. These highly skilled foreign-born doctors in training are applying for H-1B visas. And long wait times and the delays I mentioned have doctors worried in the U.S. about possible shortages, especially for rural and underserved populations. Illinois is actually one of the top three states in the country that brings in doctors on H-1B visa programs. I'm joined now by Kristen Harris. She's an immigration attorney at Harris Immigration Law in Chicago. She's also incoming president of the Greater Chicago Chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Also on the line with us from Chicago, where he's attending the American Medical Association meeting this week, is Dr. John Cullen, president-elect of the American Academy of Family Physicians. Kristen, Dr. Cullen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kristen, can I just start by asking, for someone who may not know, what is an H-1B visa? What is that supposed to be meant for as a visa category?
Sure. The H-1B visa is really the most, I would call it the default professional work visa, the predominant non-immigrant temporary visa for an individual to come to the United States who has at least a bachelor's degree or higher or the equivalent thereof, and a position that requires at least a bachelor's degree or the equivalent thereof. In terms of this piece, and you're mentioning the incoming international medical graduates, the H-1B visa is the dominant postgraduate medical education visa for those physicians. H-1B visa is one of the two types of visas that resident physicians and fellow physicians can hold during graduate medical education. The initial stay, any given one-time stay in the visa category can be up to 3 years. It is renewable up to 6 years, and then there are exceptions that permit it to be renewable even beyond those 6 years. So hopefully that gives you a little background about the H-1B.
I think so. That's helpful for folks. Dr. Cullen, how many doctors are there who are using H-1B visa programs in the U.S. right now?
I'm not sure what the number is for total H-1B visas, but in terms of resident positions, there's approximately 4,000 non-U.S.-trained physicians, and of those, 1,000 are here on an H-1B visa.
And how important is it? Yeah, and how important is this program then for filling the needs of for medical needs of communities across Illinois? I mentioned rural and underserved areas. What does that look like when it comes to immigrant and immigrant doctors?
Well, certainly in terms of rural and underserved areas, immigrant physicians are extremely important. I mean, they're a basic, a fundamental part of the workforce in rural communities and rural hospitals. That's also true for residency programs. And so, and the reason why this is such a critical issue right now is that July 1st is when the new classes start. And we still have 1,000 resident physicians who have not received their H-1B visas.
So what will happen if they don't get those in time?
Well, since they're a critical part of the physician workforce within hospitals, because they're the ones who really run the hospital services and actually most teaching hospitals across the country, that there's going to be an enormous confusion. There's just not going to be enough workforce. The H-1B visas in particular are useful and hospitals are serving underserved populations. And so if July 1, those visas are not granted, then there's going to be a severe shortage of physicians who are seeing patients.
We're talking about visa delays and what that means for doctors in the U.S., and particularly here in Illinois, with Dr. John Cullen, who's president-elect of the American Academy of Family Physicians. And Dr. Cullen, your group was one of several national medical groups that signed a joint letter to the U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement about your concern regarding these delays. Now, I know these delays have happened before. This time around, was the delays in processing was around wage data? What are you hearing from customs and immigration officials at this point?
So as we understand it, the issue is that the Department of Labor does not have information on resident salaries. And instead, they've always used the AAMC, the American Medical College's information on wage data. And for some reason, the Department of Immigration has decided not to use that data, and instead it's going to come up with their own guidelines. Unfortunately, like I said, we're kind of coming up to a time-critical point.
And what response have you all gotten from that letter, Dr. Cullen?
We have not received any response. We have heard that from the AAMC that they that guidelines are going to be authorized, but that is all that we've heard at this point in time.
I mean, at this point, I imagine you're pretty worried. They're cutting things pretty close. It's June. What does the time frame normally look like?
I'm not really sure, but there's going to be a significant processing time delay as well, as just once they approve of the guidelines. And we would prefer that they continue to use the AAMC data and start to work at authorizing these visas. You know, there's some programs where 60% of the physicians in the program have H-1B visas.
Wow,
and so
it's not just
there's one here, one there. There's some, especially in programs that are serving underserved populations. And I'm sure that is probably true in Illinois, where a significant proportion of the physicians are there with H-1B visas.
Kristen Harris is also with us. She's the incoming president of the Greater Chicago Chapter of ILA, the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Kristen, this isn't the first time that the processing of these visas has been delayed, but this sounds like this problem is a little bit unusual in the timing of this, particularly when it comes to doctors. Has something like this happened before?
Not particularly like this in the H-1B category. There have been holdups sometimes in the J-1 category. I also did want to follow up, if I may, on my colleague, a physician's great and wonderful, insightful comments for you on some of the other questions that you had, just to supplement. So one thing when you were asking about in the state of Illinois in particular, and physicians, foreign national physicians, H-1Bs, helping to meet that need, here in Illinois, there's a program in every state called the Conrad 30J Waiver Program. And here in Illinois, that program maxes out every year, meaning that there are more than 30 applicants of individuals seeking H-1Bs to work in HHS-designated shortage areas, so definitionally areas and populations that are medically underserved. So we have, you know, the fact that those are always employer-sponsored mean that we are, we are maxing out of a federal program every year for H-1Bs to come into medically underserved communities and populations. So that's just, you know, one indicator there of how specific this is to Illinois. That's true of other states as well, but wanted to get that local angle in there. Now, the CONRAD program is for postgraduate medical education, going back to graduate medical education, internships, fellowships, residencies. As a good doctor noted, the U.S. Department of Labor has no wage data that is specific to graduate medical education. It sort of lumps together all of the private sector wages for all physicians in one sort of, I call it, bucket of wages. And then there's another what we call bucket of wages and what we call the AQUIA database. What I mean by that is a special database that is for institutions of higher education, teaching hospitals, and the like.
So, Kristen, does it sound like, does it, what you're saying then is it sound like that they're looking for wage data that doesn't exist?
Essentially, what is happening here? The contention of the physician immigration community, and by the way, I'm also on the IMG task force leadership that also deals with these issues specifically from a physician immigration standpoint. From a physician immigration standpoint, our contention and the community's contention is that there is actually such survey such wage data available, and the AAMC has been dutifully compiling that wage data. And further, it is what's called an alternate wage survey, which is one source that is permitted in the H-1B category. And by the way, very importantly, has been permitted in the H-1B category. That particular AAMC wage survey has been permitted for years and years and years, and to have an about face of an unannounced policy decision, apparently, that's affecting all these adjudications at this time in the year is really unfortunate and causing a huge impact. Also, just
so it sounds like, Kristen, it sounds like this is a new change that's been announced. I wanted to ask you something else about. We actually had someone booked to come on the program who, on the advice of their attorney, decided not to speak to us, the media, because there was a concern about having a green card application approved if they were to speak about this in the press. And this isn't someone you represent. I just want to make that clear. Mm-hmm. But I want to ask, is this a concern immigrants have, that if they speak about their case, and this was someone who was here legally but was worried about this affecting their permanent paperwork, are you hearing this from other immigrants?
I have to say, sadly, that I am hearing those concerns at an increased level. I first started hearing those concerns at the travel ban when the travel ban was first implemented in the early part of 2017. I had physician clients whereby I was arranging their anonymous conversations with Wall Street Journal, members of the press, because, yes, physicians who even already held lawful permanent residence or green card status were concerned. And these are physicians. These are educated individuals and bright individuals. But, yeah, I would say that is something I'm hearing quite frequently as a concern.
So just to be clear, you're saying that there are immigrant doctors who are in the U.S. who are afraid to speak to the press because they're worried about how that will affect their permanent immigration status.
correct that, or of their family or the like. So that is definitely what I'm hearing, and or, you know, seeking to help the press by providing information, but trying to do so on an anonymous basis, which I think only undergirds your point about, yes, there are concerns.
Dr. Cullen, as someone who is president of the American Academy of Family Physicians, I wonder what your reaction is to that, if we're at a point where even we have immigrant doctors who are here legally but are scared to speak to the press because they're worried this is going to affect a green card. You know, obviously people wait years for those.
I have not heard that specifically, but I could certainly see that fear would be there.
And I guess I'm wondering, go ahead, Dr. Cullen.
Oh, I was just going to say is that I have talked to one of the students that that trained with me that is a part of this program. And for her, the issue is that if she's supposed to start on July 1st for her second year of residency. And the other problem with this for the physicians is that with residency, you really have to start it at the right time. There's very limited amount of time to take off. And so if things don't start on July 1st, she's going to have to repeat that after the program is done. So however long it takes before she gets her H-1B visa will have to be tacked on at the end of her third year in order for her to graduate. But then that causes all sorts of other problems for programs because they're really not designed to have additional physicians working at that time. So this is if these physicians don't start on July 1st, it's going to cause repercussions not only for them in the short term and not only for the programs, but it's going to cause some long-term disruptions as well.
And what about disruptions to the healthcare system, Dr. Cullen? What about for people
absolutely.
Who are patients? What do you anticipate may happen there?
Well, so unfortunately, I hate to say this, but July 1st is a chaotic time anyway. So we have our new interns that where they're really they have just received their MD degree and then they're just starting to see patients on their own really for the first time. And they're being supervised by third year residents and then attending. And so this likewise disrupts that whole thing. It's going to cause a tremendous amount of chaos over July 4th weekend, basically.
And so we're thinking about chaos, Dr. Cullen, just to be clear, in emergency rooms, as well as in this is really mostly, I would think, in teaching hospitals across the country, correct?
That is correct. But most hospitals have residency programs. So it won't just be in emergency rooms. It'll be in the inpatient setting, outpatient settings. It's this is going to cause much bigger chaos than it might appear just by the numbers.
Kristen, from your perspective as an immigration lawyer, have we ever been in a situation like this in your recent memory?
I think that first of all, to this scale, no. And with regard to the H-1B category, no. Again, this is for physician immigration. I can say that in terms of delays at the consulate in the J-1, in certain consulates in the J-1 category last year, that seemed to be kind of the first, not the first year there had ever been an individual delay here or there, but one of the first times where the numbers, whereby you had J-1 visas getting held up on non-immigrant intent issues, whereby even the support and additional information of what's called the ECFMG interfacing with the State Department was not necessarily able to eventually resolve those J-1 visa applications abroad. So the scale is very different, but in terms of something that was somewhat parallel in terms of impacts on the start of the year, there would be that. One other kind of component of this delay as well is that teaching hospitals are afforded payments from CMS based on the census of who is there, how many numbers do they have there of residents, et cetera, et cetera. So the payments from CMS can be impacted, although defer to the doctor who's, you know, I'm an immigration attorney. The doctor may have more of a sense of this, but that could potentially also impact the budget of these institutions that may already have, you know, great budgetary restrictions.
Right. I'm afraid we're out of time.
Oh,
so I'm going to have to stop you there.
Okay.
I guess all of this does sound like this could be it's already causing a lot of problems, not just for you all as we're talking about this, but for the healthcare system. So I appreciate you taking the time to give us some more information about this. Kristen Harris is an immigration lawyer with Harris Immigration Law in Chicago. She's also with the Greater Chicago chapter of ILA, the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Dr. John Cullen is president-elect of the American Academy of Family Physicians. Kristen, Dr. Cullen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to be getting an update with the Consul General of Guatemala about the situation in his home country and that volcano, as well as recovery and relief efforts right here in Illinois. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On June 3rd, the Volcán de Fuego, or Volcano of Fire, erupted near Guatemala's capital. 2 days later, it erupted again, and more than 100 people have died. As many as 200 others are still missing. This disaster has affected the lives of not just the entire nation of Guatemala, but Guatemalans around the world and people here in Illinois. We're home to about 50,000 Guatemalans living mainly in the Chicago area. Community members have been trying to find ways to support those who need help more than 2,000 miles away. I'm joined now by Billy Munoz, who's the Consul General of the Guatemalan Consulate in Chicago. Thank you for taking the time to be here. I'm sorry that it's under these circumstances, but welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Nailu, for the opportunity to talk about this disaster. Thank you for the opportunity. And yeah, this is not the quite good circumstances to meet, but the thing is that we as a government are trying to get together with all organizations, with governments, international institutions, in order to help the people that are affected, almost 3,500 people that are right now in shelters habilitated by the government, almost 2 million people directly affected of this eruption of the volcano. And the other thing that is important to mention is that the reconstruction of the country, of those communities that were erased from the map, Los Lotes and El Rodeo, it will be the next step for the government.
Mm. Consul General, can I ask where recovery efforts stand right now? First, as you've just laid out how big and vast this problem is. Is it clear that the volcano has also stopped erupting?
Well, the reports that we have from the CONRED, that is the National Coordinator for the Reduction of Disasters, that is the institution in charge of all of this situation, we have reports that the volcano is still making some eruptions. And not only the volcano of Fuego, the fire volcano, also we have an active volcano, the Pacaya, that both volcanoes are in big activity still. And another thing that the rain season begins in May, so the lahar material with the lava and the rocks that are in the mediation of the volcano make that things of rescue more complicated if you zoom or add that it's raining a lot right now.
Mm.
The efforts, we are very impressed of the solidarity of the Guatemalan people, not only in Illinois, in all the Midwest, that is the jurisdiction of this consulate. I am very proud of my people, very happy that a lot of organizations, institutions had been made events, fundraising, and we are trying to participate as a consulate, as a representative of the government in all events that are happening here in the state and in other states.
Consul General, as we were talking about that, I know that you all have been speaking to different community groups, as you're saying, not just in Chicago, but Illinois, but across the Midwest. Can I start by asking what you think the most important thing people in Guatemala do need right now?
The for example, we received a notification actually yesterday in which the shelters are not receiving more clothes, for example. Here, where weather is cold, and the area that...
Looks like we have lost the Consul General. We're speaking with Billy Munoz, who's the Consul General of the Guatemalan Consulate in Chicago, talking to him about the Volcán de Fuego, as he's talking about the two different eruptions that have happened, or the several eruptions that have happened near Guatemala's capital. We've just tweeted out, by the way, the Facebook page of the consulate, if people want to support that efforts there, as we were just hearing Consul General Munoz. We're trying to get him back here on the line now, but as he's saying about needs and what we've heard, particularly from community groups, is we always hear in natural disaster situations, normally the most important thing to send is money. That's an easy thing to send when we're talking about Guatemala, and that's 2,000 miles away. Again, if you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We just tweeted out that Facebook page. We'll also have it at our website at 21stshow.org. As we have been trying to speak to the Consul General for Guatemala. Let's hold on for just a moment here. Looks like we've got the Consul General back on the line here. Consul General, just wanted to just check in with you as we're talking about relief efforts. What do you want people in Illinois to do?
Well, to get together, the solidarity shown for Guatemala is really amazing. Keep trying to donate. We have the official bank accounts and other organizations that are making efforts to have money for rescue teams, trying to send money to Rotary organizations, trying to send money to the church. We are trying to make all these efforts in order for canalize all this help to our country.
And just so to be clear for everyone listening, how much of the country is affected by this in terms of physical effect?
Like, for example, I want to give you an idea of the area. Guatemala, it's like the dimension of the size of a Tennessee state in the United States, 108,000 square kilometers. So the affected area basically is three departments, three states, Guatemala, Escuintla, Chimaltenango, and a part also of Zacatepec, is the part of the Antigua Guatemala state. It's about the 30% of the country. It's a huge area. So the efforts that we need, I think that the communications get down when I was telling that we need medicine, food, clean toothbrushes, things for people that are now in shelters, and for the efforts. Thank you very much for what all you are doing here in Chicago and other states.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. That's Consul General Billy Munoz of the Guatemalan Consulate in Chicago. Again, we'll have all of that information at our website if you're interested in helping. Our thoughts are with you. Thank you for taking the time to be with us, Consul General.
I will send you the information. Thank you, really. We appreciate all your audience, and I want to thank you, and God bless Guatemala. Thank you very much.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
The whistle. It's done! It's over! Trinidad has dethroned the United States, knocking them out of the World Cup.
If you're a fan of men's soccer, you might remember that moment last October when the U.S. men's national team lost to Trinidad and Tobago. The shocking upset meant that the U.S. men's team failed to make the World Cup to qualify for the first time in 31 years. Even though the U.S. isn't in it, the World Cup is still the largest sporting event in the world. It starts this week, tomorrow morning, and soccer fans all over Illinois are getting ready. Cooper Kennard is joining us now. He's vice president of American Outlaws Bloomington on the line now to give us a preview. Hi, Cooper. Welcome to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
Cooper, before we start, I have to make a confession to you. My family is from Trinidad, so I'm not at all apologizing for what happened with the U.S. men's team, but I just wanted to say, no hard feelings?
No hard feelings, although I will be honest, I haven't heard Bob Lay's telecast from that evening in a while, so it just brought back a lot of repressed memories, but no hard feelings whatsoever.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And first, I watched a lot of the last World Cup with American Outlaw fans in bars in Chicago. For people who are not familiar, can you tell us a little bit about the American Outlaws? What is it that you all do?
Absolutely. So the American Outlaws, and I represent as the vice president of the Bloomington chapter, the 81st chapter of the American Outlaws. So American Outlaws, it started in Lincoln, Nebraska. It's the premier soccer supporting group for the United States in the country. So the group as a whole, we have a mission, vision, and value of supporting our United States men's and women's national teams and going where they are, being where they are, and ultimately helping to grow the game, not only in our local communities, but as a collective force to grow the game here in the United States.
That said, when we're talking about this World Cup, I imagine you have lots of mixed feelings about the Cup this year.
just a few, but to be quite honest, this is still a phenomenal just event from a sporting standpoint in an international community. And really, it's a chance for, you know, players all across the world to take off their club jerseys and represent their country. So at the end of the day, whether the United States is in it or not, it's still going to be an amazing spectacle.
So let's talk about how to jump on different bandwagons since we are not cheering for the U.S. Can
sure.
I ask you, who are you most excited about competing in this year?
So the great thing about the World Cup is since it happens every 4 years and it's down to a couple of weeks for a full month in a specific host country, there's a chance for a lot of narratives. So while I am red, white, and blue through and through, there are a couple of narratives that I'm really enjoying looking forward to this summer. So one, and this will actually be the team that I will be cheering for and representing, is Team Iceland. So you think of Team Iceland, and this is a country of around 300,000 individuals whom are making and appearing in their first World Cup in history. They are almost like the little engine that could.
And they've got the whole Viking thing they've been talking about, right, Cooper?
Absolutely.
So who doesn't want to cheer for Vikings?
Oh, no. And they all raise their hands. They yell skull really loudly. And it just evokes memories of you know, Viking movies, and it's just a great experience. It really brings the whole country and the whole atmosphere pretty electrically. But yeah, this is their first World Cup, so I'm really looking forward to supporting them and kind of following them throughout the World Cup this summer.
What about players? And I'm thinking in particular, who are you most excited about? Who we should be watching out for?
Absolutely. So you have a couple of different players to watch. There's always going to be a couple of players that shine throughout the World Cup that we may not know of, but a few common household names. So you think of Lionel Messi, arguably one of, if not the best player in the world from Argentina. He has not won a large major tournament in Argentina's history as a player. And so this is an opportunity for him to really show the value that he brings to his country. Then there's for the other side of the best player in the world coin is a guy by the name of Cristiano Ronaldo from Portugal, whom everyone loves to talk about, including Cristiano. So a really great opportunity to kind of see the David versus Goliath of a guy like Cristiano, who's really going to lead his team Portugal during the day. And then I would say there's another name that some may need to be on the lookout for, an Egyptian player by the name of Mohamed Salah.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, I'm super excited about him.
Yeah, so great player. As you may or may not seen, he set the Premier League record this year for goals. He had over 40 goals in all competitions for Liverpool. And pretty dramatically, Egypt is qualifying for their first World Cup since 1990. And had it not been for an injury time penalty against Congo, scored by whom else but Mohamed Salah, they wouldn't even be in the tournament. So they're really looking to for him to kind of carry their hopes for glory this summer.
Yeah, we're super excited about Mo Salah. So in the opportunity to cheer for a country like Egypt, I want to thank Cooper Kennard for being with us, Vice President of the American Outlaws Bloomington. Thanks for being with us, Cooper. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
That does it for us today. I'm afraid we're out of time. Tomorrow, we'll actually be talking about Ramadan, the end of that, Eid. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day.